start. Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated November 4th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's front page, top of the fold, Prison Health to be outsourced for $1.5 billion by Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. The State Department of Correction is working to privatize the delivery of health care for its 40,000 inmates to a single provider under a 7-year contract that could top $1.5 billion. At present, the state provides statutory required care through a network of 2,000 state employees, nurses, and doctors, as well as contracts with hospitals and outside physicians. Those state employees would be put out of work, though they would have an opportunity to apply with the chosen vendor. Each year, the state spends $250 million on inmate health care, says Frank Rogers, Department of Correction Deputy Secretary for Administration. The vendor that receives the contract would be responsible for all aspects of inmate health care, including medical, dental, emergency, pharmaceuticals, mental health services, health care personnel, program support services, and all related support services and expenses for inmates, according to a proposal distributed to potential vendors, and will assume all risk of a fluctuating prison population. Essentially, the state wants to outsource all aspects of medical care. We do not want a piecemeal system, Rogers says. The projected date for a vendor to take over is summer 2013. To be sure, the vendor would subcontract portions of care, but the state's intentions are to deal only with one vendor in the same way someone would deal with one contractor when building a house, even if the contractor subcontracts for roofing, for example. Brentwood, Tennessee-based Corizon is a company that specializes in providing correctional health care and will submit a bid for the North Carolina contract, says John Walker, Corizon Senior Vice President of Business Development. He says vendors subcontract some work, mainly for specialty care. Most providers work directly for the vendor. In any case, a state contract would be one of the larger ones for any vendor. Corizon was formed when PHS Correctional Healthcare merged with Correctional Medical Services Incorporated in March. In 2010, PHS parent company, America Service Group Incorporated, managed 57 correctional healthcare contracts with a total average inmate population of 162,209. That year, it generated $630 million in healthcare revenue and $10 million in net income. The North Carolina contract would be nearly worth $250 million a year. Still, it wouldn't be the largest. Michigan contracts with Corizon to manage health care for 50,000 inmates, and Florida is bidding for a vendor to oversee a system of 100,000 inmates. Arizona and Pennsylvania also are looking to outsource correctional health care. We are seeing a trend away from self-operated models, Walker says. North Carolina Department of Correction has made other strides in prison health care. It is set to open a $150 million five-story, 167,000-square-foot central prison hospital and mental health facility, with services including diagnostics, radiology, dental, dialysis, pharmacy, physical therapy, emergency, pre- and post-op, surgical, medical records, and administrative operations. It also has a five-story, 149,000-square-foot, 210-bed mental health facility, and a three-story, 102,000-square-foot health care facility for women, which opened this year. Until now, most hospital care for inmates has been contracted to hospitals, and that entails obvious security risk, says Don Dalton with the North Carolina Hospital Association. Security personnel accompany an inmate at a hospital, but there are still risks. You wouldn't want an inmate put in a room next to someone's mother or grandmother, Dalton says. In some cases, such as emergency or specialty care, the vendor would negotiate a contract with area hospitals, similar to what the NCDOC currently does. We have, right now, a pretty important relationship with the Department of Corrections, says Kevin Fitzgerald, Chief of Staff at the UNC Healthcare System. UNC Healthcare provided 15.5% of all inmate care in the 2009-2010 fiscal year and 19.1% in 2010-2011 through UNC Hospitals in Chapel Hill and Rex Healthcare, its wholly owned hospital system in Raleigh. Going forward, Fitzgerald expects to continue to provide care when the prison hospitals come online, as well as work with the vendor when that company takes over. He praised the new prison hospital, saying it will reduce security issues at community hospitals. I think they are going to provide a real improvement, says Fitzgerald. And now, Four Oaks will close branch and look for capital. By Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. Four Oaks Bank says it will consolidate two Garner offices and actively assess its capital raising options in the face of year-to-date losses of $6 million through September 30th and mounting problem loans. CEO Aiden Lee says the plan is to fold the Four Oaks Garner office at 574 Village Court into the branch at 1408 Garner Station Boulevard, which is a Raleigh address but is essentially in the Garner retail market. The move is expected to be completed in November. Meanwhile, Lee added that Four Oaks managers are actively assessing our alternatives for improving capital, including the sale of additional shares of common stock, reducing our balance sheet, or other strategies. Lee made the statements in a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission outlining Four Oaks' financial performance for the third quarter and year-to-date. The bank's nine-month 2011 losses of $6 million as of September 30th were 3% less than a loss of $6.2 million Four Oaks posted for the same period in 2010. Moreover, from third quarter 2010 to third quarter 2011, bank managers were able to cut in half both their provision for loan losses from $20 million to $10 million and their bad loan charge-offs from $18.4 million to $9.6 million. Despite those positive developments, loans classified as not repaying increased by 23% to $63.5 million during the first 9 months of the year. Restructured loans, those in which a bank is trying to work with the borrower on an amended repayment plan, have held steady in the $48 million range, according to the filing. Lee says Four Oaks problem loans are centered in its real estate portfolio, including construction, land, development, residential loans, and commercial real estate. Four Oaks is adequately capitalized under regulatory standards. If managers do decide, as a capital-raising strategy, to offer shares on the market, investors will take notice by virtue of the bank's size, $915 million, and location, says Southern Bank analyst and former regulator Don Coker. That part of North Carolina is still considered to have a better economy than other regions, and so an investor would see this as a way to get a foot in the door, he says. Since Four Oaks is operating under heightened regulatory supervision, underwritten agreements with the Office of North Carolina Commissioner of Banks and the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, however, any outside investors would want a deal on the shares. Banks under such formal enforcement action, as a rule, can see the price of their shares discounted by as much as 40% of book value, according to Memphis Bank attorney Jeff Garish, who studies the effects of enforcement actions. This week's lead article, Kane Gearing Up, Second Hotel, More Apartments for North Hills, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. North Hills developer Kane Realty Corporation will kick off another round of development in 2012, including construction of North Hills' second hotel in its third apartment community. A Hyatt House extended stay hotel, formerly known as Hyatt Summerfield, is expected to break ground before the end of December and should open by spring 2013, says John Kane, president of Kane Realty. demolition of the Lantern Square apartment complex, and construction of a new multifamily community to replace it within the Ramblewood neighborhood near North Hills should also be starting by the second quarter of 2012, he says. In spite of the economy, we're doing pretty good, Kane says. Kane has formed a joint venture with Concord Hospitality Enterprises of Raleigh to build the 7-story Hyatt Hotel in a deal that is similar to a joint venture forged with Concord to build the Renaissance Raleigh at North Hills Hotel in 2008. The Renaissance is doing very well, Kane says, pointing out that a new restaurant, Mia Francesca's, opened in late October inside the hotel. Davidson & Jones Construction Company of Raleigh is the general contractor for the 157 Hyatt Hotel project that will be built at the corner of Park and Market Streets on the east side of Six Forks Road. The Ramblewood apartment project has been on the drawing board since Kane and his partners bought the 150-unit Lantern Square property in 2006. He says the first phase of the redevelopment will include 220 units, with eventual build-out at 420 apartment units. We'll be coming back with more rental property, but obviously much nicer than what is there now, he says. Lantern Square opened in 1968. But not every piece of North Hills news has been rosy. Kane has frozen any plans to restart construction of the Cardinal at North Hills Retirement Community Project after withdrawing the project's application with the State Department of Insurance in October 2010. Kane says the Cardinal project has not been canceled and changes to the design continue, but he could give no updated timeline on when construction might begin. Capital for senior housing, especially for new starts, is non-existent, he says. Healthcare, REIT, of Toledo, Ohio, is a financing partner for the project, but a representative of the company did not return calls for comment. Lack of activity at the Cardinal has prompted construction contractor Fortune Johnson Incorporated of Atlanta to put a lien on the property, claiming non-payment of more than $433,000 in site development work at the Cardinal. Fortune Johnson operations manager Jared Ford says the companies are working on a settlement and are in the process of removing the lien on the property. Most of the site work was completed more than a year ago, he says. There's still peace and harmony between us and the developer, and we'll continue to work with him on other parts of the property, Ford says. Kane also confirms that the firm had scouted for buyers for the Park and Market apartment and retail complex earlier in 2011 to see what kind of price it could fetch. We got a lot of positive reaction, he says, but we decided not to move forward. We're keeping it. Inside the front page, Bridge to Crabtree may come with redos, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh, the owners of two aging apartment communities across Glenwood Avenue from Crabtree Valley Mall are proposing two ambitious redevelopment projects that could fast-track a proposed pedestrian bridge across the busy thoroughfare. The Raleigh City Council in 2008 ranked the $1.5 million Glenwood Avenue pedestrian bridge near Marriott Drive among its top priorities for pedestrian projects, but neither the city nor the state has yet identified funding for the bridge, according to Eric Lamb, Raleigh Transportation Planning Manager. Two rezoning applications filed in October, though, detail plans by the owners of the Northampton Apartments and Richmond Hill Apartment Communities to tear down the more than 40-year-old buildings and redevelop the properties with a higher density of apartments and retail space. Under the proposed rezoning request, the Northampton owners could build up to 500 new apartments and 50,000 square feet of retail to replace the 112 apartment units built in 1967. The Richmond Hills property, which has 71 units on Charles Drive, could include up to 512 new apartment units or 296,626 square feet of office space on one tract and a maximum build of 404 apartment units or 234,056 square feet of office space on a second tract of land. The property, which was built in the 1970s, was sold in February to EYC Companies of Foley Beach, South Carolina, for $1.65 million. Both the Northampton and the Richmond Hills rezoning applications are scheduled for a January 17th joint public hearing before the Raleigh Planning Commission and the Raleigh City Council. They are on prime land, says Scott Brown, president of Grubb Properties in Raleigh, which formerly managed the Richmond Hills property, but is no longer affiliated with its ownership. The units are functionally obsolete for the location, so redevelopment is a good play. And if a pedestrian bridge is built connecting the properties with Crabtree Valley Mall and its retailers, it's a home run, he says, of the proposed projects. Like in Glenwood South, it's the whole walk factor. 20 and 30-somethings want to be able to walk to restaurants and places nearby. Residents of apartment communities on Lead Mine Road and visitors to the Marriott and Embassy Suites Hotel on Marriott Drive currently have to cross 10 lanes of traffic to access the mall's stores and restaurants. Joseph Call Sr. of Raleigh, who is one of five local owners of the Northampton property, says the group has been meeting with city staff to keep them informed of their plans and will wait to see what the city council approves. The property is strategically located and it's time for a change, he says. We're just taking it one step at a time. A Glenwood Avenue pedestrian bridge, which would intersect with the crossing at Marriott Drive, was on Raleigh's 2011-2017 Transportation Improvement Program list, but the project was not listed on the updated 2012-2018 TIP list, says Chris Luscanza, planning manager for the Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization. This is something the city could still do on its own or join with the state, Lucanza says. I believe they are still pursuing it, but I'm not sure how high it is on the priority list. The bridge, also, is not among projects that will be funded by $40 million in transportation improvement bonds, approved by Raleigh voters in October. Raleigh Transportation Planning Manager Eric Lamb did not return calls for comments. Next up, investments up 82%, refills a pot at Gold Leaf by Lee Weisbecker. The Rocky Mountain-based Golden Leaf Foundation chalked up an investment gain of 82% for the year ending June 30, helping it overcome legislative cuts. The economic development nonprofit's nearly $800 million endowment brought in $122 million in investment income and gains during fiscal 2011, up $66.7 million from the year before. Breaking down the 2011 results, Golden Leaf saw $25 million in actual cash income and $90.5 million in paper gains in terms of investment values. Last summer, General Assembly lawmakers, looking for money to make up the state's gaping budget hole, voted to strip $17.5 million from Golden Leaf during each of the next 2 years. As it turns out, actual cash income on investments during fiscal 2011 exceeded the first year's legislative cut by $8 million, or 32%. We had a good year in investments, outperforming our benchmarks, says Golden Leaf President Dan Gerlach. The July through September quarter was tough for investors, but the last 30 days have helped mitigate that change. The investment returns were included in a recently released independent audit of the foundation, which annually receives half of the state's share from the 1998 Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement, or MSA, with big tobacco companies. Golden Leaf's mission is to support economic development efforts that help once tobacco-dependent rural communities in the state diversify their economies. It performs that task by making grants supporting various types of development projects. Golden Leaf received $69.1 million from the MSA in fiscal 2011, according to independent auditor BDO. It awarded grants valued at $49 million, down 31% from the 2010 grant award figure of $71 million. Asked about the decline, Gerlach says that 2010 grant figure was made artificially high by including, for accounting purposes, all of a $24 million payout to MCNC, once known as the Microelectronics Center of North Carolina, to help develop a rural broadband network. Actual payout of the $24 million will happen over 3 years. As for its investments, Golden Leaf finished fiscal 2011 with $793 million in its endowment, up 24% from the prior year. Roughly 46% of the cash was in domestic and international stocks, 18% in hedge funds or absolute strategies, 13.8% in bonds and U.S. treasuries, and 10% in private equity investments. The positive direction mirrors national trends among foundations with endowments to invest. Losing money in 2009, foundation investments nationwide began their recoveries in 2010, and managers were hoping to consolidate those advances in 2011 despite volatility in stock markets, says Mark Carpenter of the Arlington, Virginia-based Council on Foundations. The council is currently crunching numbers for its latest investment survey. As for Golden Leaf, which is in 2009 lost $142 million on its investments, 2011 marked a year of political pressures, including a legislative attempt to strip the organization of its entire MSA payment. Lawmakers later settled on the $17 million figure. They did, however, disband another MSA recipient, the North Carolina Health and Wellness Trust Fund, which financed anti-smoking and other health programs in the state. That group closed its doors on June 30th, according to its former spokeswoman, Barbara Monkees. The group's holdings at the time, some $32 million, were transferred to public health programs, and two MSA payments, totaling $50 million, were diverted as well. Next up, license plate probe. Legislatures concerned about contract breaches at stores, by Chris Bagley. From Raleigh. The North Carolina General Assembly has begun a review of the Division of Motor Vehicles and its supervision of the method for issuing license plates after 8 contractors were shut down for fraud and other breaches of contract. The Program Evaluation Division of the legislature began a review in October and is scheduled to wrap up by the end of April, legislative employees say. The division is a nonpartisan investigative arm of the General Assembly, analogous to Congress's Government Accountability Office. The legislature and Governor Beverly Perdue authorized a review in June. While the legislation calls for an evaluation of efficiency and does not mention fraud or mismanagement by license plate agencies, it follows the ejection of 5 contractors as LPAs in the span of 2 years. Most recent was a contractor in Siler City, which was cut off in February. The DMV has since terminated its contracts with operators in St. Paul's and Greensboro after investigations found evidence of notary fraud. The DMV announced in October that it had closed the agency in Eden, north of Greensboro, on October 26, saying DMV contractor Tanya Dillon was charged with 4 counts of using false information to apply for a vehicle registration or title. DMV inspectors alleged that Dillon was registering and titling vehicles without requiring a North Carolina driver's license. "We'll definitely be looking at the LPA's activities in addition to the DMV's activities," senior program evaluator Kiernan McGorty says. McGorty declined to discuss specifics, saying the evaluation had just begun. Most of the 120 license plate agencies across the state are run by private parties under contract with the DMV. 9 are run by county governments, 5 by town governments, and 3 by chambers of commerce. The DMV itself runs 1 large location each in Raleigh, on New Bern Avenue, and in Charlotte. Contractors receive $1.43 of the $28 fee for issuing a license plate, $1 for each title issued, and $1.27 each time they collect the 3% highway use tax on the state's behalf when a vehicle is sold. DMV spokeswoman Marge Howell says the per-transaction fee structure is maintained in the June legislation. In adding or replacing a contractor, the DMV advertises the new contract and reviews applicants based on their business experience, business plans, and financial wherewithal, Howell says. The agency also checks references, performs financial and criminal background checks, and requires several weeks of training, Howell says. The June legislation directs the DMV in selecting an LPA for a particular geographic area to give preference to contractors over state-run offices. Outgoing Senator Debbie Clary, a Shelby Republican who chairs the Senate Program Evaluation Committee, said the committee had not specifically examined fraud by or decertification of LPAs, which she called purely a function of DMV and between the agencies, their attorneys, and the DMV. The current DMV enforcement actions. The DMV says it canceled its contracts with the following license plate agencies after investigations found evidence of fraud or mismanagement. The Yanceyville LPA. Details are unavailable. The Winston-Salem LPA, number 140, former employee charged with obtaining titles under false pretenses. In Lexington, the contractor and employee charged with a total of 38 felony counts of entering false information on title applications. In Forest City, contractor and two others charged with felony forgery on applications for handicap placards. In Siler City, the contractor pleaded guilty to four misdemeanor registration violations. In St. Paul's, the manager and employee charged with hundreds of misdemeanors and felonies. In Greensboro, manager and two others charged with multiple felonies. And in Eden, manager charged with four misdemeanors, the employee charged with two misdemeanors. Next up, Yusko's firm lining up social fund for Texas retirees plan. By Lee Weisbecker. From Chapel Hill. Earning a hefty return is one thing. Investing with a social purpose is another. Mark Yusko's Chapel Hill-based Morgan Creek Capital has launched an effort to prove the two goals are not incompatible. Locking arms with the Texas Employment Retirement System, or ERS, Yusko has started a fund to commit $50 million of the ERS money into so-called emerging managers in the real estate field. Emerging managers are investment shops run by women, African Americans, Hispanics, and people of Asian descent. ERS, which has $23 billion in total assets and which manages the retirement benefits of more than 300,000 public employees in the Lone Star State, has committed $2 billion to help minority managers get off the ground. The program was the result of a legislative initiative in 2010, explains ERS spokeswoman Mary Jane Wardlow. Following the Texas legislature's directive, ERS began looking for investment experts to help it deploy the cash, signing on Credit Suisse, San Francisco-based Legato Capital, and Morgan Creek, among others. As of April, $553 million of that $2 billion total has been invested or committed, including the $50 million to Morgan Creek, according to ERS investment head Jacqueline Johnson. For Morgan Creek, one of the region's biggest money managers, with $9.2 billion under management, as of August 31st, the ERS infusion might represent but a drop in the bucket. Even so, Yusko and his lieutenants have been burning both iPower and shoe leather to locate appropriate emerging real estate investors. As of early summer, according to a report to the Texas legislature, Morgan Creek had tracked down 668 possible firms to receive a slice of the cash, including 59 women-owned operations, 24 African-American-owned, and 14 Hispanic and 5 Asian. The report doesn't say how many of those, if any, were located in North Carolina, and attempts to reach Yusko were not successful. Moreover, Morgan Creek representatives have met with 107 potential managers, including at least one Texas-based real estate investment house with a 40% Hispanic ownership. Morgan Creek has even agreed to join hands with ERS to hold a first-ever Emerging Real Estate Investors Summit slated for Austin in January. Pension systems in states like California, Illinois, and New York began adopting emerging manager programs more than a decade ago, says Matt McHugh of New York-based Emerging Manager Monthly. The practice slowed somewhat in the immediate wake of the financial problems of 2008, but has since revived. This is Morgan Creek's first fund devoted to emerging managers, says McHugh, who follows the fund-to-fund investment company very closely. And now, with new terminal and rebounding economy, cabs stay busy. Fares are up by 33% for RDU cabs since 2009. By Chris Bagley from Morrisville. Taxi ridership has risen dramatically over the past 2 years at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, a development that operators ascribe to a rebounding economy and the opening of the redeveloped Terminal 2. RDU Taxi Incorporated, which holds an exclusive contract to queue at the airport, has recorded an average of 5,550 fares each week, up 33% from 2009. Company President Charlie King says international and business travelers account for much of the increase. He also credits the taxi's prominence outside Terminal 2, which was renovated and reopened in phases over the course of 2009, 2010, and 2011. Numbers from the Triangle's hotel industry, which serves many of the same travelers who use airport taxis, reflect a recovery in business-related travel. Monthly night stays, a key measure of demand, began to rebound in late 2009, and the annual total is on track to break a 2007 peak by about 8%, according to Smith Travel Research, an industry consultant. Airline traffic has also increased since 2009, albeit weekly. The number of passengers deplaning at Raleigh-Durham grew by 0.4% in 2010, has grown by 1% in 2011, and is on track to finish 2011 at about 4.6 million, short of the 2007 peak of 5 million, according to airport statistics. International traffic has grown much more strongly, but accounts for only 2% of the passengers at the airport. But RDU's taxis traffic has grown in 3 of the last 4 years, with a relatively small dip in 2009. And King says the economic recovery alone can't account for the continuing acceleration. Location, location, and location are key, he says, even for a company with a contractual monopoly such as his. For passengers of the airlines who have relocated to the new terminal, the taxi stand's curbside location just outside is much more visible and accessible than the location of the taxi stand at Terminal 1, which required cab hailers to do a bit of exploring around a corner, he says. We were kind of out of sight, out of mind, he quips. At Terminal 2, neared completion in 2010, the company's taxi traffic grew by 11%. It has grown by 19.8% in 2011, putting it on track to finish the year with about 289,000 trips, according to an analysis of data that were provided by airport spokeswoman Mindy Hamlin. The terminal's final phase opened in January, and JetBlue relocated in May. The increased traffic doesn't directly represent growing revenue, which consists primarily of flat weekly payments from a fixed number of cab drivers. But King says the quickening pace of business could play into a renegotiated limit and now set at 115 cabs, perhaps when the current 5-year contract expires in December 2012. Drivers generally own the cabs, which they have painted black with gold lettering and logos to the airport's specifications. Drivers keep what they receive as fares and tips, covering their own gasoline and maintenance, and turning over a fixed amount each week to King's company. From that amount, RDU Taxi pays the airport a fixed fee as well as wages for its own dozen-plus employees, mostly dispatchers at the two taxi stands. The quickening pace of business for the 115 cabbies often means quickening speeds on the highways, according to some Triangle motorists. One morning last year, when northbound traffic on North Carolina 147 was backed up because of a lane closure, Duke University database analyst Pamela Ahrens says an RDU taxi passed dozens of cars by taking the closed lane, then accelerated to 80 miles an hour after passing the choke point. Ahrens is one of several drivers who have complained to a designated staffer at the airport. It seems like I either call the RDU staffer or feel like I need to call her about once a month, says Aaron, who frequently shares the southbound lanes of NC 147 with the taxis during her commute home to Cary as they return to the airport. They're just tailgating everybody. They're going to kill somebody. And now, Study to Track Best College Paths to Finding Good Jobs by Matt Evans. From Raleigh. Legislatures and economic developers have put a lot of responsibility on North Carolina community colleges to successfully retrain the state's workforce. Now a new research effort will help the colleges identify just what paths through the system turn out to have the best job outcomes for students. A federally funded project by the Center for the Analysis of Post-Secondary Education and Employment will analyze student transcripts and various forms of state employment information to see how a student's chosen course of study impacts his or her future employability, according to Arnie Kallberg, a professor of sociology at UNC Chapel Hill and a lead researcher on the project. The transcripts and employment information won't be personally identifiable, Kallberg says, but they will be individually linked, so that researchers will be able to compare how a student who completes a non-credit continuing education curriculum does in the job market compared to a similar student who got a professional certificate or an associate's degree, or who took courses online rather than in person, for example. Research should be more thorough than many past efforts, he says, because it will not only rely on the students to self-report their outcomes. Kallberg says it's already clear that community colleges are one of, if not the most, effective tools to transition workers from disappearing jobs into employment with a future. But it's less obvious how to use that tool more efficiently. It will be nice to know exactly which forms of instruction and which curricular features are more or less effective than others, he said. Is online training as effective as in-class? And if so, for what kinds of work? That's the sort of thing we'd like to know. That's especially true given the state's critical funding situation that resulted in a 10.7% system-wide reduction in the current budget, said Sharon Morrissey, the chief academic officer for the North Carolina Community College System. With resources at every campus stretched thin, it will be valuable both academically and financially to have a better idea of what works and at what cost. One piece that will be studied here will be our non-credit training programs to see if students who use them do the same, better or worse in the job market than those who spend more time and money getting a formal credential. There's a cost differential and a time differential, and this will help us guide students depending on their background and the amount of time and money the students has to invest. Similar research will take place concurrently in Virginia, Florida, Michigan, and Ohio, and work is getting started now, Kallberg says. The study is formally planned to take 5 years. The study will include a special focus on certain regions within the state, he added. Matt Evans is a reporter with the Business Journal of the Triad. Next up, GSK wants $22 million from firm it says reneged on contract. By Chris Bagley. Research Triangle Park. GlaxoSmithKline is suing a Seattle-based biotech company for alleged breach of contract after the biotech's weakening sales forecast for its prostate cancer treatment prompted it to drop GSK as a supplier. GSK, whose U.S. headquarters is in Research Triangle Park, calculates that Dendron Corporation owes it $22 million in relation to a treatment for advanced prostate cancer. Dendron had engaged GSK to supply a protein compound to be used in Provenge, the biotech's recently launched prostate cancer treatment. GSK was expected to begin supplying the protein known as PA2024 in early 2012. Dendron, which has a manufacturing facility in Morrisville, had expected Provenge sales to propel its revenue to more than $350 million in 2011, from $48 million in 2010. But Dendron withdrew that forecast in early August when it reported its second quarter financial results and said in a September 1 securities filing that it was canceling the supply agreement with GSK and would pay GSK $4 million. In its October 27 lawsuit, GSK alleges that Dendron owes it about $22 million, including $17.6 million in orders and $4.4 million for unspecified equipment and materials. Since September 15, 2010, GSK and Dendron have moved forward with the various activities necessary to manufacture PA2024, according to the lawsuit filed on GSK's behalf by Womble Carlyle attorney Press Millen. Provage is not a drug per se, but rather a process that reprograms the patient's own immune system to attack prostate cancer cells. Blood is drawn from a patient, and white blood cells, known as dendritic cells, are enhanced with proteins that dendritins say help the body to identify the cancer cells. The blood is then reinfused. The treatment, like the leading chemotherapy for prostate cancer, extends patients' lives for about 3 months, says Paul Godley, an oncologist at UNC Chapel Hill's medical school who administers Provage. Provage's big advantage, Godley says, is that it entails few chemo side effects. The trade-off is that it costs $93,000 for a typical year-long course of treatment, significantly more than chemo. In reducing its sales forecast in August, Dendritin said some doctors had expressed doubts that insurers would cover the treatment. Minuscule amounts of PA2024 go a long way. Dendritin had contracted GSK to deliver 700 grams of PA2024 in the first quarter of 2012. Analyst Chris Raymond of Robert Baird & Company notes that PA2024 and the $22 million figure cited in the suit are drops in the bucket for GlaxoSmithKline, which reported revenue of £28.4 billion, that's $45.2 billion at current exchange rates, in 2010. Contract manufacturing is a very small but regular part of our business, as it is for other companies in our industry, GSK spokeswoman Sarah Alsbach says, while declining to comment on the lawsuit or the specifics of the contract. But the headwinds with Provage have been a major setback for Dendritin. Dendritin's market value fell by about $3.6 billion after the reduced sales forecast. Its shares closed trading November 1 at $10.94, implying a market value of about $1.63 billion. The company has said its difficulties led it to cut an unspecified number of its 1,600 employees. Representatives at Dendritin's Seattle headquarters didn't return phone calls to answer questions, including Provage is produced in Mooresville. The prostate cancer treatment is Dendritin's primary product. And this lawsuit was filed in Superior Court for Durham County and transferred to North Carolina Business Court on October 28th. Next up, no insurance, no problem for franchise doctors' offices. By Jason DeBrun from Cary. Two Triangle doctors have launched a company to franchise a business model for primary care practices that charge patients directly and avoid traditional health insurance. Physician Care Direct grew out of the experiences of doctors William Lawson, Brian Forrest, and a third partner, Chris Schuffner. The doctors say their own experiences prove that the model will deliver more profit to physicians' practices, and they believe it will appeal to small business owners as an alternative to group health insurance. The current business model is flawed for primary care practices, says Lawson. Insurance can add a tremendous amount of value, not just in primary care, says Lawson, who goes by BJ. Physician Care Direct helps primary care practices establish a fee structure outside the insurance framework. In the case of Forrest's own practice, $399 a year plus a $20 scheduling fee provides help in managing chronic diseases, standard exams, and lab tests. Other services are available as needed and charged accordingly. Physician practices may set their own rates and service structures or adopt Forrest's plan whole cloth, that being the franchise model. In either case, Physician Care Direct receives a fee from the practices, which are free to continue seeing traditional insurance patients as well. Practices receive access to a web-based software platform that organizes and codes all the billing. Patients with insurance can send the receipt to their insurance provider for a potential rebate. Paying for health care might change dramatically as more provisions from the new health care law take hold. One aspect that might make the direct pay model attractive is that if employers offer direct pay subscription to employees, they would be exempt from the additional tax charged for not authoring health insurance. Forrest practices in Apex under the direct pay model. He previously had a practice in Greensboro that accepted health insurance, with staffing in place to do the filing and coding. He says the cost of dealing with insurance providers forced him to make his profit in volume, which meant seeing more patients. It's called patient milling, and it does happen, says Schaffner. Rate contracts with insurance companies and overhead costs for billing and collections left Forrest with as little as 25 cents for every dollar billed. Worse, because he saw patients for a fraction of the time he wanted, health outcomes declined. In some cases, costs associated with collecting a bill will be higher than the charge itself, so practices simply write off the bill as a loss, says Dr. Jeffrey Kane, president-elect of the American Academy of Family Physicians. I actually think that this is a sign of a dysfunctional payment system, he says. Forrest stopped accepting insurance and decided to deal only with patients who would pay him directly, hoping to earn roughly the same amount of money but have less of a headache. What actually happened amazed him. Although he charged less per patient, he made more money because collections were virtually guaranteed and overhead costs were cut by two-thirds. In addition, he spent more time with patients who then started seeing better health outcomes. Forrest stuck with his model and helped other physicians who wanted to go the same route. He received national acclaim for his model, and a growing, albeit small, number of doctors have made the switch. About 2 years ago, Lawson approached Forrest with a grand idea. They could help practices implement the model with the hope that it would catch on and change the world of primary care. Lawson is no longer practicing, focusing instead on building the franchise company. To find patients, the group is targeting small business owners who want to offer health insurance but find it cost prohibitive. Garner Chamber of Commerce President Neil Padgett says he has received calls about affordable health insurance. Now, through a partnership with Physician Care Direct, any Garner Chamber member can receive a discounted rate. Timber Commons Family Practice, a new practice in Garner, will open this winter as the first franchise model. And now it's time for a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. Leading North Carolina's Habitats is her mission. As president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity Valley of the Sun in Phoenix, Christine Odom oversaw one merger between local Habitat affiliates and set a second merger in motion. A Greensboro native and former social worker, Odom had joined the Phoenix affiliate to raise money from churches in a region that was home to four affiliates, then became development director and eventually CEO. I knew there was capacity for more fundraising and potential homeowners to be served, she says. Now, after 8 years in Phoenix and then 4 years at Habitat International in Atlanta, most recently a senior director of global engagement, Odom, on June 21st, became the first president and executive director of the newly formed Habitat for Humanity of North Carolina. North Carolina is home to 81 Habitat affiliates. Roughly 25 of them are run solely by volunteers, and North Carolina ranks third among the states in production, with 430 units completed in the fiscal year ended June 30, 2010, mainly new houses, but also those that were repaired or rehabilitated. Habitat affiliates serve all but 10 of the state's 100 counties, although tiny affiliates serve roughly half the state, Odom says. Building the organizational capacity of the state's Habitat affiliates, particularly smaller affiliates, represents one of the big goals of the new statewide group, one of the nearly 30 statewide Habitat groups in the United States. The statewide groups aim to provide technical assistance and training to Habitat affiliates as they increasingly move beyond just building new houses in their efforts to fight poverty and are now weatherizing, repairing, or rehabilitating existing houses. A big challenge for Habitat affiliates in North Carolina, Odom says, is a lack of fundraising experience. Affiliates typically raise most of their money from churches, corporations, government, and special events, with smaller affiliates getting most of their money from government grants and special events. With the economy making donors more selective and hurting corporate giving in federal, state, and local funding, Odom says Habitat needs to do a better job connecting its fundraising to its well-known brand, raising awareness throughout the state about the role that Habitat plays, providing training for local affiliates, and looking for opportunities to help them collaborate with one another. A new website for Habitat for Humanity of North Carolina, for example, will list all the affiliates in the state, including links to the websites of affiliates that have them. And an internal intranet will provide resources for affiliates and help them connect with one another. With a startup grant of $100,000 from the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation in Winston-Salem, smaller grants from Habitat International, and voluntary contributions from most affiliates in the state, the statewide group will provide training for affiliate staff, board, and volunteers, and at statewide summit and regional workshops. It will also encourage smaller affiliates to share development positions and try to coordinate funding requests by multiple affiliates to foundations and corporations. The ultimate goal of this position, Odom says, is to get more families served. Cohen is editor and publisher of the Philanthropy Journal. And now the legal focus from Jim Verdonk. The upside of downturns in fixing broken businesses. People sometimes complain their industry is in trouble. If only they were in a better industry. They inevitably want more customers, double-digit year-to-year market growth, fewer competitors, increasing prices. Business paradise, right? Yes, but personal experience recently reminded me business paradises create fat, dumb, and lazy businesses. My father died this summer in a state with an aging population. Funeral homes there have it made in the shade now and probably for the next decade. Lots of people die and a finite number of local competitors. Find a location near a cluster of churches and retirement communities and your business is golden. So they run their businesses like customers should be grateful for service. The problems my family experienced included unreturned phone calls, lack of instructions, and spelling the family name wrong on printed materials. My mother didn't appreciate incompetent service at a stressful time in her life. I waited a few months before writing this article so it would be less of a complaint piece and more of a learning lesson. What can we all learn from this? We learn business need constant reminders, not to take customers for granted, especially when you have a large captive market and few competitors. That's one reason market downturns are good for businesses. Businesses without competitors often die when markets change because they lose their killer instinct. We don't like getting sick every year, but getting sick periodically frequently provides immunity from infrequent killer diseases. What doesn't kill us makes both our bodies and our businesses stronger. So, after 3 years of an economy with the flu, most businesses have developed immunity. They instinctively fight the disease. Employees with bad attitudes were fired in the first wave of layoffs. Layoffs motivated good employees to become great employees. Professionals like lawyers and accountants actually answer telephones and return calls. Carpenters, plumbers, and other craftspeople actually show up at an appointed time, or at least call to say they'll be late. People don't laugh when you ask for price estimates and time schedules. Instead of taking wild guesses, they actually think before they promise something they can't deliver. Businesses solicit customer feedback and try to rectify complaints. Businesses try to retain repeat customers to stabilize revenue streams. They know they can't rely on growing markets to compensate for lost customers. I know you are doing these things. You wouldn't have survived if you hadn't started building good habits into your business. The million-dollar question is, will you revert to bad habits when the economy starts growing again? Chances are you've heard about someone you know recently selling their business for $5 million. Chances are that person is no smarter than you. Chances are they didn't have more capital than you. So why did they get the big check and you're still barely surviving? Chances are they didn't let their business backslide each time the economic downturn changed to prosperity. Resist that temptation every business cycle for 20 years and your business can't help but become more valuable. Oh, before I forget, my mother fixed that lazy undertaker. She's moving to live near my sister in another state. Lesson number one, don't mess with my mom. The Biz Column loves college football, even in the Big Ten, which in these wacky days of leapfrog a league, has 12 teams. Durham-based Cree probably doesn't pick favorites, but the Biz is guessing the company has a special place on its balance sheet for the Wolverines of the University of Michigan, or at least for its stadiums and arenas. Cree, a producer of high-efficiency LED lighting, was chosen to upgrade the entire scoreboard at the Big House, where the football team plays, with high-definition video displays and scoring systems that feature Cree's Screen Master high-brightness LEDs. The scoreboard replacement project began in March with the addition of two lighthouse outdoor LED video systems and a total of 6 million LEDs, which stands for light-emitting diodes. Positioned in each of the end zones, the high-resolution LED video boards are 40% larger than a previous system. Cree didn't just go for football, though. It also installed screens at the Yost Ice Cream Center, Ice Center, and home to the Wolverines hockey, and the Chrysler Arena, home to Michigan basketball since 1967. Replacing the center-hung scoreboard that was installed in 1998 with a four-sided LED video system complete with 14 LED video displays. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the TBJ will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.